I got involved with skinheads back in Vancouver, and my mom would say, like, what are you doing with those guys? You're smart, you've got your whole world ahead of you. And they had one thing that I didn't, that I wanted to have, and that was toughness. And in order to have their protection, I had to have their respect. And in order to have their respect, I had to participate in all the same violence.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thank you for joining us to discuss an important and troubling issue for all Americans, the increasing prevalence of hate crimes. What are the root causes of violent extremism, and what encourages young men to get involved in hate groups? To help us understand this complex equation, we have Professor Michael Kimmel. He's Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Stony Brook University in New York, and author of a fascinating book on the subject, Healing from Hate: How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight, in addition to Professor Kimmel, we have two guests. Tony McAleer flew here from Vancouver, Canada today, and Frankie Menk flew in from Des Moines, Iowa. Both of these men are former neo-Nazis, and both are founding members and speakers for the group Life After Hate. So they're going to take over from here.
Well, I want to say it's really an honor for me to be here at the Cambridge Forum. And I'm especially happy to be here with Tony McAleer and Frankie Menk, whom I met in doing the research for this book. So let me just start with you, Tony. Yours is not a typical trajectory. How did you get into the movement, and what were your experiences in it?
I think to explain that, I'd have to go back to my childhood a little bit. And if you can remember a time in your own childhood, like around 3 or 4, because nobody comes into the world as a skinhead, well, maybe as a skinhead as a baby, but, yeah. but neo-Nazi.
Don't judge.
And I think of who was little Tony at that time, and it was bright, curious, sensitive, mischievous, defiant, definitely stubborn. And open to the world, and stuff happens, and we stop being open to the world, and we build walls, and we shut down feelings, we put on masks and pretend to be something that we aren't to keep ourselves safe. For me, I was 9, and I walked in on my dad with another woman, and that rocked my world. That was the day that God fell off the pedestal. Anyone remember that day? I think we all have one of those. We all got that day. And I felt betrayed by all the authority figures in my life. And I was incredibly angry. And I started going from A's and B's at a private Catholic school to C's and D's by the time I was in the next grade 5 or 6, I think. And the teachers got together with my parents, and they said, well, we've tried to motivate him, but nothing seems to be working. And my dad just said, well, why don't you beat him? And if I didn't get an A or a B on major tests and assignments, I was walked down to the office. I had to put my hands on the desk and read the teacher's name. And who's heard this one before? This is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. I'm not sure who it was supposed to comfort, but it wasn't me. And as that happened over and over and over again, I can't count how many times it happened, I'd never felt more powerless, and to this day, than time after time after time, bent over that desk, hit with a yardstick. It didn't work. My grades didn't get better. I acted out more and ended up at boarding school in England. And while I was there, I got involved with the skinheads when I went for weekends at my grandfather's house. I was originally born in England. And I really vibed with them, and it was, I got involved with skinheads back in Vancouver, and my mom would say, like, what are you doing with those guys? You're smart, you've got your whole world ahead of you. And they had one thing that I didn't, that I wanted to have, and that was toughness. When I was with them, I felt safe. And in order to have their protection, I had to have their respect. And in order to have their respect, I had to participate in all the same violence that they did. And I didn't come from a violent household, so it was new to me. I had to kind of, okay, I use my right hand now, and it felt weird, and there was all kinds of crazy feelings. But after a while, I didn't feel anything. I got numb to it, And the adrenaline rush from it and the feeling of having power over people was intoxicating. And the more I did that, the more notoriety, more fear that was generated. And I grew up, no one was afraid of me because I wasn't a tough kid. And I felt safe with that. And I kept pushing it to further extremes. And within the skinhead movement, there was a large number of skinheads aren't racist. And then there's this small nugget of skinheads that was. And that's where I went. And the more I went, the more people feared me. And that was the sense of power. And what I got from it was a sense of camaraderie, brotherhood. I got a feeling of power when I felt powerless. I got acceptance when I felt unlovable. And I got significance when I felt invisible. And it's, you know, you're absolutely bang on with those deeper psychological drivers. With Life After Hate, after Charlottesville, we got this letter from a mother who said, my son, he's 18, he's got Asperger's syndrome, and he's online and up to his eyeballs in this white nationalist stuff. And she said, I'm really terrified. She said, what scares me the most is these white nationalists have embraced and accepted my son in a way that no one in his entire life ever has. That is the type of deep, visceral, psychological drivers that we have to address. And if you're going to pull somebody out of that, you have to address that before anything. Mm-hmm. You know, when we try and talk to, if we try and, you know, people write to us and they say, well, what, my uncle's, he's into this white nationalist stuff. Can you give me some arguments I can say to him? And I go, well, what's your intent? I said, if your intent is to have an argument, I can give you some stuff mm-hmm. If your intent is to bring them out, that's not going to work. Because for those people, and like I was, my identity and ideology become intertwined. And when you attack the ideology, you attack the person's identity, and that never is going to persuade someone.
Mm-hmm. Frankie, why don't you tell your story?
So, I was born and raised in South Philadelphia with my mom. We grew up in a very Irish Catholic neighborhood, and my mom actually went and the last name I have now isn't my real last name. I was born with actually an Italian last name. I was born with the name Bertolini, so it was Frankie Bertolini. And when my mom left my dad, she moved back to the Irish neighborhood. They changed my last name, and they gave me Mink. Mink isn't even Irish, but as long as it wasn't Italian, it was cool. You know what I mean? And that's just how our family. And so we moved back to this neighborhood. They take my last name, and I was also at Catholic school. And I remember the day the teacher asked the nun, Sister Mary Agnes, asked me to stop writing the name. I was learning how to write cursive. So I was writing Bertolini, and it's a long name. So when she said, write Mink, I was like, yes. Like, yeah, that's cool. I mean, I'm very lazy. So so I had an identity crisis right there. I mean, I remember having food stamps. You know, now they have a little EPT credit card, but back then they gave us them booklets of neon-colored money that screamed, look at me, I'm the poor kid, right? And you go into a corner deli in South Philly, who comes in the door right behind you? The hottest girl in your neighborhood. And you can't pull out food stamps in front of a hot girl. That's not balling, so. I remember being embarrassed, and so my mom got remarried to a man, and she just latched onto whatever she could that would work and for her, and it didn't work for me. He was a very abusive. He was an old boxer, so he used to tell me every day he was going to beat the Italian out of me, and he would try it pretty regularly. So the acceptance of who I was, put it this way, for the first 2 or 3 years that man lived in my house, every day my goal was to be hit by a car. And so I always wanted to get hit by a car. Now, everyone in Philly gets hit by cars. It's just like here, there's small streets, everyone drives around, it's always your cousin that runs you over. So, but like I wanted to get run over because I didn't want to die, but I knew I would go to a hospital. I wanted to go to a hospital. I wanted to go to where I could sit in my bed and not have to worry about if my stepfather was going to come upstairs. And so, as me and Tony both will tell our stories, I'm not giving you an excuse for anything I've ever done, but I'm giving you an explanation. I got kicked out of my home. I had to go move in with my real dad, who I don't really ever get to see much. My dad has a bar in Southwest Philly. He lives up like in the Fresh Print, where Fresh Print's from, you know, around that area. I move up into that neighborhood. I'm one of the only white kids, let alone go to an all-black school. I was a little punk rock skater kid a little bit, so now I'm fist fighting at school every day. And I'm an athlete, and I'm making all the sports teams. I've made it on the baseball team, which was an all-black baseball team. For 7 years, they were all black. They won like 5 championships in a row. I'm like the reverse Jackie Robinson. I'm coming in, they all hate my guts. But I was a good enough athlete that it kept me on the team. That summer, I stopped going to that school actually by the end of the year. I cut the last 47 days of school and they still graduated me. That's how great our school district was. 47 days of school I missed every day and they graduated me. That summer I went up to Lancaster, Pennsylvania where my cousins lived. And my cousins were originally from South Philly. And I went up there and they live around all Amish people. I mean, like, they have no electricity. Like, they really turn butter. Like, they don't, like, wait for white people to come, oh, let's reenact this. They really live that way. And that was fascinating to me. That was National Geographic stuff. But my cousin was up there. He was going to get into this neo-Nazi group. And Tony made a couple of really good points about this, where what first attracted me to them was, for one, they'd always give me a beer. I'm turning on 14. These guys are, like, 17, 18-year-old guys with cars, tattoos. They have fight stories. And they would hand me a beer. And my cousin, who was the youngest of the guys, would always say to them, like, he would say to them, you don't understand. My cousin Frankie lives in, like, one of the worst neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And all these big, bad neo-Nazi guys would sit around with their beer and ask me, what's it like? Like, do you really see black people every day? This one girl said to me one time in front of everyone, do you really take the bus? She said, no, yeah. She goes, you really take the bus with black people? And I was like, yeah, I take the L train. Like, I have to take the L train to get to school. Like, yes, I see black people. With that being said is, my parents, both of them, when I walked in, I could have a black eye, I could come home from hockey or football, whatever sport, and they would never say, how'd you get that, son? How's school today? How's life? What's going on with you? They never asked me those questions. They just didn't have time for it. Those guys asked me what's it like growing up around black people. With someone saying, how's your day? How's life? And it sucked. So that was my first introduction into this thing of, because now it really became more of an us and them. And it may really, really help with that divide that because of all these other people, I'm having these troubles in my life, you know? Because of all these other things, these outside influences. And then the talk about growing up in a neighborhood like that, you always hear neighborhood racism, you know, keep them out of our neighborhood. And I remember there was one joke that always used to get said, even by my uncles, they'd always say, don't Jew me. And everyone laugh. How do you start a Jewish parade? You roll a penny down the street. Ah. And I was like, I didn't get it as a kid. I didn't get the joke. So I asked my uncle, Michael, I said, what's so funny about that? And he started to explain to me a little bit. He's like, well, see, the Jews are kind of notorious for the, you know what? You'll get it when you're older. You'll get that joke when you're older. My first neo-Nazi meeting I'm ever at, they start talking about how the Jews secretly run the Federal Reserve. Now, to bring the Federal Reserve up to a 14-year-old, I'm 41, I still don't know what the Federal Reserve is. It's just bad news. But these guys are bringing up that the Federal Reserve is secretly run by Jews. And in my first meeting, I got the joke. I was older. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, I became a pundit, just like Sean Hannity, in a way. I only read things not to learn knowledge. I read it for arguments and, you know, ammunition in an argument. That's all I would read everything for. Anything I would learn about was just for, I wanted to be able to fight with the adults in my life because they left me to fend for myself. And that was my first real introduction into it, I guess. Mm.
I remember the first time I heard you tell that story, Frankie, that it was just very powerful for me when you said that, like, when these guys were asking you in Lancaster, like, what's it like growing up, that for you it was sort of like a kid coming home from school and having your parents say, how was your day, son? What's going on with you? That was the first time you felt seen. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something that's really key in a way in terms of this validation is to be seen. You know, you really matter in the world because you've been told for so, you know, in many ways that you don't. So was there a moment, a click moment, when you sort of said to yourself, this is not where I want to be in, let alone now, in 5 years or 10 years. What was it that began the process for you of saying, something is wrong here, and I have to do something about it? What was that like for you, Tony?
I think it was definitely around the birth of my daughter, and then my son 15 months later. And My mom and dad are both English. My dad used to get mad at Sunday dinner and his eyes would get all buggy. We used to call him the bug. My mom was a middle-aged English woman and she used to be like the beak and she was always pecking at me and my brother like, Tony, don't go out with her. She'll ruin your life. She'll get pregnant on you. She'll ruin your life. So I was with this girl after, you know, 3 months and we were worse than Sammy and Ronnie on Jersey Shore. And she tells me I'm breaking up with her the third time that week, and she says what no 22-year-old wants to hear. I'm pregnant. I'm like, oh. But then, you know, the ideology says, you know, you've got to have babies, and, you know, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children is the famous, infamous 14 words. So, but I was terrified to tell my mom she was pregnant. And I was pretty estranged from them, and we went to family dinners, and she carried low and wore baggy sweatshirts, and we kind of left it to the last minute, and I called my parents up, and I'm like, hi, Mom, it's Tony. Michelle's pregnant. Like, you what? I told you, you ruined your life. You ruined your life. You idiot. And I, you know, she drops the phone, and I hear the phone banging against the wall back in the days when phones had cords. Mm-hmm. And I hear footsteps go across the kitchen floor, and I've never heard so much profanity come out of the mouth of a middle-aged English woman. And I hear my dad's heavier footsteps come along, and he picks up the phone, and he's a doctor, right? He's like, Tony, what's your mom all upset about? And I said, well, it's Michelle. She's pregnant. Really? Are you sure? And I'm like, oh, yeah. and he goes, well, how far along is she? I said, 7.5. 7.5 months, and you didn't tell us. I said, no. The contractions are 7.5 minutes apart. I'm calling you from the hospital. But, you know, half an hour later, I'm holding this beautiful little baby girl, and she hasn't opened her eyes yet. She's giving a little scrunchy face. And she opens her eyes, and, you know, my face is the first picture her brain's going to take. And, you know, I thought and I'd said I'd be dead or in jail as a white revolutionary at the age of 20 by the time I was 30. You know, and all of a sudden, you know, that what crept in was, is that fair for me to do that to her? Mm-hmm. You know, and when my children were born, for the first time in my life, you know, I started thinking of someone else other than me because I was a total narcissist. Mm-hmm. Everything I was doing was about grandiosity, self-aggrandizement, and I didn't care who I hurt in the process as long as I could get attention, acceptance, approval. We can't, that's what love is, right? We can't find that in a healthy way. We find it in an unhealthy way. And the beautiful thing about children is they're safe to love. You know, with my son born 15 months later, I'm not even going to tell you that story. My children asked me once, when they were about 15, driving home from the movies, they said, Dad, were we planned? And I said, absolutely, son. I just wasn't aware of the plan. But they're safe to love, and their compassion is unconditional, and their love for us is unconditional, and it started a thawing process. They're not capable of ridicule. They're not capable of shaming. They're not capable of rejection, at least not till about 13. And so it allowed a safe space for me to drop my guard, to allow, you know, because I would have presented like a sociopath, but I had those connections. I just cut them off, and with that, the connections, I was operating totally from my head. But now I was starting to operate more and more from my heart. And with my son in particular, I got to parent him the way I always wanted to be parented, which was extremely cathartic. My dad, I know my dad loved us, but he worked 80 hours a week, and his way of showing love was to be a great provider. What I needed as a little boy was time and attention, and as a psychiatrist, the last thing he wanted to do when he walked in through the door at home was to deal with someone else's problems or someone else's day or whatever. It was like being abandoned by a parent living under the same roof. It was strange, but the children started that thawing process. By the time they were 4 and 6, I was a full-time single father. And at that point, you know, I had a choice to make. My mom, she loved me, you know, and here's the second piece of compassion that comes in. She loved me unconditionally, but my relationship with her was very conditional. And I needed her to help raise the children. And so it's a really powerful thing that compassion, when it's combined with healthy boundaries and consequences, she used that very effectively to, you know, like you said, you got to give this up or I'm not helping you with the children, and sort of forced me. But I was going there anyways. The challenge is how do I leave the movement and keep my identity intact, right? That was the mental gymnastics that the ego had to do to try and justify leaving. And how I justified it was I'd gone to the Supreme Court of Canada twice, involved in all kinds of tribunals and hearings, and I was exhausted, and I just said, why should I be like fight for a bunch of white people who couldn't care whether I lived or died? If I really want to save the white race, I'll focus on these two children to make sure they thrive and survive. And that's how I justified leaving the movement, but keeping my identity and my ideology intact.
I remember in our first interview, you said something that gives me an idea of how far you've come back. You said to me, I assumed I would be dead by 30, and I was okay with that.
Yep.
You were okay with that. And I just remember you saying that. And, you know, we were on the phone at the time, and I went, make sure you write that down. You know, it's like, and because it was a really, really interesting thing, because suddenly you weren't okay with that. You had a reason to live.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Frankie, you have a somewhat different story about being in prison, I think, that I think is really, really interesting about how you first had that moment of realization.
So I go in, I was 17 years old when I went into adult maximum security prison. I was in the same prison with John Wayne Gacy. He was still around at the time, and I'm 17, and he killed like 33, 17, 18-year-old boys. And I remember that, so there's the white guy, but I was with this white gang, and they took care of me because I was young, and I had my own TV show before I got put in prison. So just to give you a little bit of backup. But when I got there, I was still a 17-year-old kid who wanted to run and play, and I'd just been locked up in a county jail, waiting trial for almost a year or whatever it was. So when I got up there, I just wanted to go out the yard. And so some days they would have neutral days, so no gang activity. It would just be a neutral football day or something. And I started going out and playing football with a lot of the black kids from Chicago, so they're all these Chicago kids. And I always noticed I had more in common with them than I did my own gang, because they're all Aryans. They're all bikers from Southern Illinois. Like, I've never been on a Harley in my life, but I could tell you about an L train, and these kids could tell you about an L train. So there was little commonalities like that. But there was G and Jello were two of the kids I kind of hung out with a lot, and I could tell you that I know when I look back on it now, there was days when I would hear one of their voices, like maybe out playing playing cards or something, and it would just bring a smile to my face. Like, I knew I wanted to go sit with them, you know, because they just made me laugh, and I made them laugh. I'm a pretty funny guy. So, but I'll never forget. So, this is, I can tell you by historical things what happened. Michael Jordan's dad gets killed while I was in prison, in South Carolina. But some of the black extremists in prison are screaming, you know, the white man killed. They didn't find out yet who killed his dad. So they made this big thing, and they're all yelling about how it was white people that killed them because Michael Jordan was the most popular black man at the time. And I'm like, that's kind of corny, but whatever. What happened was that we're all watching it. We're sitting in the day room in this prison, and we're watching it. And they find the kids that killed them, two black kids. They didn't know it was Michael Jordan's dad. They just tried to rob a guy with a Cadillac. Well, everyone's sitting around mumbling and talking, and I said to my own crew, and I don't say this word anymore, and I'm not going to say it now, but I said typical N stuff, N word, you know? I said typical N stuff, right? And people laughed over here or whatever. And then later on that day, me and G, we're going to go play in a spades tournament, and me and him used to cheat, right? This neo-Nazi and this black kid from Chicago, we would cheat playing spades, and we win all the tournaments because we give little hand signs to each other. No one thought we would team up like that, but we did. So anyway, I'm giving G the signs to come back and load diamonds. I'm like, keep giving the sign with my finger, like, come back and load diamonds, and he won't come back in the suit I want so I can cut him. Anyway, that's all spades talk, but whatever. At the end, I went up to him, and I'm like, dude, I know you had low diamonds. Why didn't you throw them? And he goes, I guess it's just typical N-word, you know? And he said the same thing. He goes, I guess it's just typical N-word stuff, huh? Mm-hmm. And it just kind of like stabbed me right in my heart. Like, here's a dude who I really look forward to every day talking with. No matter what, I was still part of this movement. I liked the kid. And here I hurt him pretty bad because he thought I was his boy. And here I said that, you know? And I used to say that word 50,000 times a day. I overused that word, and I will never use that word ever again. And I'm okay with that. So that was one of the things. But I mean, there was, when I got out of prison, I still wanted to be part of this movement. It was my whole identity. Again, a perfect example. I mean, it was just my whole identity was being part of this. I was this leader. I had the markings, and I was an egomaniac with no self-esteem. That's what most people are like me. I'm an egomaniac with no self-esteem. When you tread on my sneaker, I punch you in the mouth because I think you're being disrespectful to me. I would go after you, even the guy I kidnapped. I don't even know if he really was disrespectful to me. I just heard through the grapevines that he might have said something about me at a party from some girl, Rachel. You know what I mean? It's like, I didn't know how to handle. My self-esteem couldn't step in and say, Frank, don't worry about what they say about you. You're a good guy, you know? Mm-hmm. And it goes just like to the way when I recruited people. If I'm talking to a guy, and to go with the ideology part of it, it is the camaraderie. But I remember the very things that some of you even hear. People say, oh, well, they get BET. They get BET. Why don't we get white entertainment television? Now, this is at the time when Friends was real big, and there was no black people on Friends. So, you know what I mean? That was very white entertainment television everywhere. But at the time, we were victimization. Why do they get that, and we don't? And, well, white entertainment television is a horrible acronym. It's more of like a porno network than it would be a, But when they would say things like, I just want to be proud of my heritage, man, I could grip onto that. And I could say, well, come join my group. That's what we're about. We're about being proud of your heritage. And you're hearing that a lot now in today's world. I'm proud of our heritage. It's code. It's a code word. Proud of my heritage. When I would go to a guy and say, if you want to be proud of your heritage, well, come join my group. And then they come join my group. We never once talked about our heritage. We always talk about their heritage. Right. And look what they're doing. You can only talk about Leif Erikson so much, right? So racism in all forms is the greatest bait and switch ever pulled on you. It's, yes, come join us. You can be proud to be this group. You'd be proud of your this and that. We never talk about them.
Right.
We always talk about others because you can't really look. Look, becoming part of a white supremacist group or any supremacist group is the most laziest thing in the world. I'm being proud of something I didn't even achieve. My parents just happened to have sex, and I became out this color. Like, it's so lazy. I didn't accomplish nothing to be part of the group except for the color of my skin. I was born that way.
Right.
So it takes these, when you feel like you don't have anything, we're making the most easiest thing in your life, your pride of something you had nothing to do with. But the way that I started to really get out of it was just relationships with people. And there was things that, like, it took me about a year. It wasn't overnight. I wasn't on the road to Damascus in blinding light or nothing. It was little things would happen. And I remember where, like, a black dude would be selling food stamps in Philly. They sell food stamps. 50 cents, well, you sell them everywhere, but 50 cents on a dollar. Guys, 50 cents on a dollar. That meant they were selling food stamps, right? And I'd say, well, see that? Maybe the movement is a little, and I'm getting just at the verge of thinking about getting out. I'm like, see, maybe the movement is right. And I'm like, wait a minute, my mom does that. My mom sells her food stamps all the time. She always has sold her food stamps. So, but she does it out of her house, so that's a little bit better. Or like an Asian person would cut me off driving, and I say, oh, you know the stereotype, you know, Asian drivers. And I'm like, wait a minute, my aunt ran over a cow this year. Like, how do you run over a cow? They're not deer. They don't jump in your way. It was already there when she got there in an established position, and she still charged it. So I could real quickly start to put those things in my head, like, wait a minute, I know somebody else that does that. Mm-hmm. And they're family members.
Yeah.
So those little things like that, but it's a gut-wrenching heart check when you have to take all the stuff you were just proud in, which you really, again, I didn't do anything to be proud of, which is white, and you're going to take that away from me.
Yeah.
And so that was the hard part.
Well, I'm sure you're all going to join me in thanking Professor Michael Kimmel, Tony McAleer, and Frankie Mink for journeying a long, long way to be here tonight and help us to address and understand this better. So thank you very much. You have been listening to Healing from Hate, How Young Men Get Into and Out of Violent Extremism, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square. Cambridge Forum is sponsored by Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Harvard Bookstore, and the Ford Hall Forum. Thank you for joining us.